If the first Barry Street Conference was in 1820, and if we met every year, save one, during World War II, and this is 2007, is this number 187 or 188? You think it's 188? 187? Anybody for 186?
It is definitely 187 or 188 or 186, definitely.
Well, I usually ask my engineering husband to figure out things like that before I leave home, and this year I forgot. Some of you know me as Alice Blair Wesley. I've been your Barry Street. I have been your Barry Street scribe for 4 years. In my years of preaching, I finally figured out how to make sure people get the main point of the sermon. You tell them right off the bat what the main point is. So I tell you now the main point of this year's scribe's remarks. You know how often you publish or announce the need for help with some program and nobody responds? Well, keep doing it anyway, because every once in a rare while, you'll really be glad you did. I will get that to that main point in just a short time, but for now, I have to tell you that this job as Barry Street Scribe turned out to be a lot bigger than I was led to believe when I took it. That has happened to you a few times, right? Sometimes I think this sentence sums my whole life. This job is way more work than I expected. Or maybe it just sums the story of ministry. Anyway, taking on one big hairy project after another does take its toll. You might not have known that. But over the years, sometimes by my choice, but more often not, I have lost, in descending order, so to speak, I have lost most of my hair, my hearing, my teeth, a pair each of cataracts, tonsils, and adenoids, two cancers, one breast, an abdominal cyst, an ovary, 8 toenails, and a couple of pulpits. So these days I feel that I really ought more accurately introduce myself as barely Alice Wesley. Of course, I'm not saying I lost all that because I worked so hard as scribe to collect and get posted on the web the Barry Street essays delivered annually since 1820. I do want, however, to boast about one thing. Shortly after we got up and going, the new online site for the Barry Street Essays at uuma.org/Barry Street, with Janet's help, we posted a request for ministers' help with the project to learn what essay might be in your church archives, you could type in the name of any predecessor and see whether or not he or she had ever delivered a Barry Street essay. Or if you didn't know your predecessor's name, you could just type in the name of your parish or town. And up would come the name of all the essayists who had served your church. Hardly any of you responded to that request for help. A few did. One who did was doing his ministerial internship at Arlington Street Church and CLF. He turned out to be the most able researcher it has ever been my privilege to know personally. He is now settled in Second Parish Hingham. His name is Paul Sprecher. Some of you know that in 1920, 100 years of scribal records were lost in transit from one scribe to the next. The conference then asked Charles Little, who was church historian at Meadville, to try to reconstitute the records. He did, and so for many years, Charles Little was the one person who knew most about the history of the Barry Street Conference. But would you believe that following the Charles Little's notes, Paul found quite a few essays that Little himself couldn't find, as well as many others given after Little died. So now I can say with complete confidence and without a doubt that Paul Sprecher knows more about the history of the Barry Street Conference than anybody ever has known, living or dead. And that's the person you elected this morning as to succeed me as Barry Street scribe. You will now have a real expert to preside over these sessions, all because I published the request for help with the program. And I got a rare response. Indeed. So keep publishing those requests for help, and I pray you may be as pleased with all your successors as I am with this latest one of mine. That concludes the scribe's remarks, and I now call together to order what I think is the 187th session of the Barry Street Conference. Traditionally, the retiring member of the Barry Street Committee is asked to lead us in the invocation. Judith Walker Riggs, will you please lead us in prayer?
O thou great source of life, whom some call God, and others find too large to name at all, 180 and more years ago, our forebears gathered together to strengthen their bond of union. They gathered walking, on horseback, by horse-drawn carriage, by boat down the rivers to Boston. We have gathered by plane, by car, by train, by bus, by bicycle, all methods of transport unknown to our forebears, perhaps not even in their dreams. And yet how little the most important things have changed. our joy in reclaiming each other's remembered faces. A little older they are, perhaps, more careworn, but very dear nonetheless. Our dedication to the well-being of each other, for though we may compete with one another, and thou knowest, Lord, how we sometimes compete for the perfect phrase, the perfect idea, the perfect congregation. Still, when anything bad happens to one of our bond of union, we feel that pain right in our own hearts. These are the deep, unseen, often unspoken subterranean streams of our ministerial lives, brought into the open, into light, into celebration here today. Sweet Spirit of life, help us hold our colleagues not here today through disaffection, through illness, through finances, through death. Whatever their reason, help us hold them in our hearts that this precious bond not be lost to a single one. And help us remember our bond of union is not always automatic. William Ellery Channing called people together to remember and work on their bond of union. We too have periodically, regularly needed to be called back to that vital task. Called back to do the vital spiritual work of maintaining our bond, a bond which matters whether or not we agree with each other, a bond which matters whether or not we even like one another, a bond which matters deep in our souls. So may it be for centuries to come, as it has been for centuries past. May grace ever lead us home to one another again. Amen.
I hope you've been thinking about whom you might elect as moderator. We need a moderator to proceed. The floor is now open for nominations, and I recognize Carol York. Carol. I think that's about enough nominations, don't I? Would you vote, if you would vote by application for Jane Jepka as moderator, please signify by raising your hand. On the other hand, you might be sitting for quite a while. Why don't you just stand up if you'd like to elect Jane? And meanwhile, Jane, you can make your way to the podium.
No question about it. The selection of the Reverend Kenneth W. Sawyer as the Berry Street essayist is a splendid choice. But why exactly? There are three things to say about Ken Sawyer. Okay, technically there might be more than three things, but there are three clumps of things to say about why Ken Sawyer belongs on the list of essayists that goes back to Channing, Tuckerman, Ripley, and the Wares. First, he has the predictable, impressive credentials degrees from Amherst and Harvard, and lifelong stalwart devotion to Unitarian Universalism. He served the association for 8 years on the MFC and chaired the pamphlet commission and the committee that designed our continuing education grants. And if we were paying any attention at all, we know that Ken has served the UUMA as president as recently as this morning. He also spent 28 years on the UU Urban Ministry Board in Boston, has worked with a long line of interns, and accepted innumerable, somewhat shorter assignments throughout the movement. Credentials include books, of course, and you'll want to pick Ken's up in the bookstore area this week, his wonderful sermon collection, Perspectives. And there's thematic preaching, the best, and yes, the only, comprehensive, Unitarian, the only Unitarian Universalist preaching textbook out there, co-written by Ken. Indeed, the second qualifying clump involves preaching. By my calculation, Ken Sawyer has listened to more Unitarian Universalist sermons than anyone in the known universe. 8 years of MFC sermons, preaching workshops in Chicago and two in Indianapolis, teaching intensive preaching courses more than once at both Star King and Meadville Lombard, and 13 years of full semester teaching at Harvard Divinity School from 1989 to 2001. He also led preaching workshops in six UUMA chapters for the European UUs in Brussels, the Unitarian preachers in the United Kingdom, and in the Khasi Hills of India, which involved listening to 8 hours of presumably excellent preaching in the Khasi language. An exercise that Ken appeared to find utterly engaging. I can vouch for this. I was there too. In fact, because I taught with Ken in all of the settings I mentioned over these couple of decades, I can vouch not only for the attentive expression on Ken's face during the Khasi sermons, but also for the care he took with every single preacher during all of those years, no matter what the country, state, school, or chapter. Which brings me to clump number three. Ken Sawyer is a minister. And you know better than anyone what that means. After serving a 34-member congregation in Holton, Maine, where it got down to 40 below, a town with 18 churches for 8,000 people, he and his family moved to our congregation in Wayland, Massachusetts. Ken has not only set the record for listening to the most Unitarian Universalist sermons, he also holds the current record for years spent serving one congregation. Ken has been in Wayland since before some of you were born, 33 years, building a big and boisterous congregation who love to hear him preach, who trust his counsel, who delight in the stories he makes up for the kids, and who find inspiration to work for justice. He models a 40-year marriage, devotion to his grown twin daughters and his grandchildren, and all of the good cheer and persistence, deep and tender compassion, smarts, and inner quiet that excellence in ministry requires. And that, colleagues and friends, is why Ken Sawyer is such a splendid choice to deliver the 2007 essay in Berry Street, the Reverend Ken Sawyer.
Thank you, Jane, for that introduction, and thanks to you and the students and participants in the classes and workshops we've done for your contributions to my thinking on the subject of my essay. Thanks as well to Judith for her prayer, and to her and the committee which selected me as this year's essayist. My thanks to Alice and Paul for their amazing work with the Berry Street. Your 4 years are as extraordinary as the brief tenure of your predecessor was utterly unremarkable, that having been me. And finally, my thanks to Kim Crawford Harvey, who will offer a response to my remarks at my invitation. I begin with two scenes, the first giving me a chance to be the first Berry Street essayist to commence with a quotation from a movie star, the well-known actor Kirk Douglas. As he tells it in his autobiography, once when he was driving to Palm Springs, he offered a lift to a young sailor who, when he got in the car and recognized the famous driver, exclaimed in his shock, "Hey, do you know who you are?" The second and more serious scene from a life that may be much like your own. There has been a sudden serious illness, or perhaps a death, and you have gone to the home where the family has already gathered. You ring the bell, and the door is opened by a relative who has driven in from a nearby town. She has attended services at the church where you serve, or you have been introduced to her at some point as the community minister who has been of service to the worried or grieving relative. She knows who you are. She may even know that you are from Iowa, served briefly in the Air Force and computer sales before you entered theological school, that you are divorced with a 7-year-old son who is having behavioral problems at school, that your parents are both social workers, one of whom is very ill, that you love international music, pick up basketball and Mexican food, and don't understand the appeal of science fiction, oysters, or jazz. Or provide your own biographical data. You know what a complex and interesting person you are. Maybe the person who has opened the door does too. At least she knows your name. Still, she turns to the people in the next room who cannot yet see you, but one can assume are curious who this newest visitor may be, and she says, "You know who it is? It's the minister." And with luck, she is right. It is the minister, somebody ready to play that particular, crucial, powerfully helpful role. They should be able to count on that. In that moment, you are not you, the fan of jelly donuts, the Red Sox, and Monet, a disbeliever when it comes to creationism and certain aspects of American foreign policy. You are you in the role of minister. That is who you are at that time, in that place. I want to talk about the mysterious, almost magical power of the minister's role. Of course, the role can be constricting, painful, potentially duplicitous, dangerous, and sometimes hard to come by, and for some more than others, sad to say. But I want to acknowledge and hold up and celebrate the chance that the role allows us if we are given it and we take it and it pretty much fits and we use it well to accomplish more than any of us mere mortals might imagine possible, enabling us to counsel, console, educate, conduct special services, lead other worship, preach sermons, offer opinions, stir people to action, and help tend the institutional needs of organized religious organizations with an authority we both earn and are given as a trust, as a gift. I have had a fair number of ministerial interns over the years. Not uncommonly, there comes a time, often when the new calendar year begins, 4 months into the internship, when interns report that they feel they are being treated differently by the congregation, that they are being granted a status, that they are being regarded as ministers. It can come earlier or later, but whenever it does, the intern can feel some measure of discomfort, or at least surprise or curiosity, some sense that they are being regarded as having a trust, respect, and authority beyond their deserving. When this happens, or even I suppose when it doesn't, I read them a section of a sermon I gave many years ago at the ordination of Maggie Redman that addresses the wonder of it all. In that sermon, I spoke in heartfelt, poetic, inspiring ways about the nature and purpose of this odd job of ours, suggesting that we are called to be mediators of mercy, agents of love, instruments of redemption, and revealers of grace. I even quoted St. Paul, of all people, from his second letter to the Corinthians. Paul was writing to the whole congregation in Corinth and other Christians thereabouts. But his words strike me as suited to the ministry, and as such, perceptive. He wrote, "Honor and dishonor, praise and blame are alike our lot. We are the imposters who speak the truth, the unknown people whom everyone knows. Dying, we still live on. Disciplined by suffering, we are not done to death. In our sorrows, we always have cause for joy. Poor ourselves, we bring wealth to many. Penniless, we own the world." I said then that there is a lot in there worth noting still relevant to the liberal ministry of today. For instance, anyone who would take up this odd profession must be prepared for praise, no easy task in itself, and also for blame, or as the King James Version puts it, for good report and ill report, for honor and dishonor, for hearing one's name spoken of well and poorly, often enough without relation to our true accomplishments and weaknesses. But, I went on to say, I want to focus on what Paul is talking about, I like to think, in the lines that say, "We are the imposters who speak the truth, the unknown people whom everyone knows." The unknown people whom everyone knows. Not everyone, but many people do know most of us, of course, in the bank, at the drugstore, wherever. There are not many jobs as public, as on stage as is ours, or more demanding of personal revelation. And yet it remains true. We are unknown. There are parts of ourselves outside the equation. We are not only who we seem to be, which we need to remember. It is not easy when your close acquaintances, your clients, your neighbors, and your employers are all the same people, as can be the case in our trade. Ministry requires that we remember that though many think they know us, there remains that part of any of us that is not tied to public perceptions, not touched by good report or ill, which must not become unknown to ourselves. I pause to inject Another nearly contemporary citation. In his retirement, the celebrated big band leader Artie Shaw had an upbeat outlook he attributed to analysis. One day, he recalled, the analyst told me, "You're through." I said, "How do you know?" He said, "There's nothing I can tell you about yourself you don't already know." That was when I knew I had finally rid myself of Artie Shaw. Soon after that, someone came up to me in a motel and said, "Aren't you the Artie Shaw?" I said, "No, I'm the other one." I have begun working out at a gym again, as I hadn't for years, because I now go to a gym just far enough from where I serve that no one there knows who I am or what I do. They would be incredulous at being told. Him, a minister, but he never says a word to anyone. He can't be the Ken Sawyer who's a minister in Wayland. Right, I'm the other one. But to return to St. Paul, Maggie and me, I said the other phrase from Paul's letter I like even better. We are the imposters who speak the truth. Those are not necessarily the words you will find in your Bible at home or the office. The original text in Greek is so cryptic as to be almost incomprehensible. So all translations are interpretations, the translator's version of what Paul was trying to say. I am using the New English Bible because of how well Paul describes our job there. For we are, of course, imposters, I said, even if we do sometimes manage to tell the truth. Mediators of mercy, agents of love, instruments of redemption, revealers of grace, who's kidding home around here? I said, even after this service this morning, Maggie, you will still be only yourself, which is a perfectly good thing to be, indeed a fine thing to be, but probably not much nearer than I am to what people can take us to be. And here is the amazing part. Not only do they expect us to be something we aren't and can't be, but something in the chemistry between our own absurd self-expectations and their deluded trust in us makes us the thing we cannot be. Paul has caught the paradox well. Imposters who may speak the truth and do more than that. Imposters, pretenders who do the thing we cannot do, who mediate forgiveness, who are midwives to communities of love and faith, just as Maggie has been for 26 years in Montpelier, Vermont, because of the role of minister that she has had there. I am aware that role is a word that is also applied to acting. Macbeth is a role. Carmelo Soprano is a role. As ministers, are we acting, performing? Aren't we supposed just to be ourselves, to be authentic? No, it is more complicated than that. It surprises me whenever anyone suggests absolute authenticity as a possibility or even a desirable goal in ministry, if by authenticity it is meant that a person is exactly as he or she appears. We cannot be who we seem to be exactly, beginning with the matter of confidentiality, the significance of which to our lives as ministers I do not think can be overstated. Again and again, we are in conversations where we seem not to know things we actually do know. And even when we don't know anything, people can never know that. Because we are always someone who might know more but won't let on. Of course, everyone finds himself or herself in that situation on occasion. But for us, confidentiality is a defining fact of the role we take on as ministers. So we cannot be purely authentic. Cannot always be open and honest. And it's not just that. There was a man in my church who died during the last church year, a delightful, funny, creative, hardworking soul who had been devoted to the church since the 1940s. He was on the search committee that called me. I had to write a part of the eulogy and find a poem to add to those that the family had picked. It took all day. I had the choice of poems down to four, all of them good, which I read over and over and wept every time. That was authentically me. The next day I did the service, read my eulogy, read the poem I had picked, and though I know my feelings for the man were evident, and you could hear it in my voice, I did not lose control. Though if I had had to go on for one more word, but I was minister. And it's not just that. Daniel Handler is the author of the Lemony Snicket books for children, a series of unfortunate events which are far less roseate than traditional fare in this field, so much so that in an interview on public radio, he was asked by Terry Gross, "Have you run into any parents, teachers, or librarians who object to either the tone or content of your books?" Handler replied, "Not nearly as many as I thought I would. There have been just a few isolated complaints I have heard. A woman in Oregon came up to me at a bookstore and said, 'You know, in one of your books, you teach that it is sometimes necessary to lie. And that seems like a very disturbing lesson to me. Can you name one time when it would be necessary to lie?'" And I was so happy that the answer came to me right away. Instead of, you know, as it usually does when people say something to you and then you think 3 days later, "Oh, that's what I should have said." Instead, it came right away, and I was able just to turn to her and say, "Nice sweater." I was really proud of that. He went on, "I mean, of course you have to lie, and I can't imagine that you would want to teach your children never to lie under any circumstances. That is not going to serve the child well when the child goes to a birthday party and is forced to say whether or not he or she had a good time." I even know one colleague who was once at a wedding reception, and an attendee told her a story that was not all that interesting. If you can imagine. And this minister feigned interest instead of being authentic and saying, "You are boring the living daylights out of me." The humorous writer Lenore Eskenazi imagined this mental process at work in an encounter at the office. "Oh, please, let's not talk. I know exactly what you're going to say. How is your summer? Everyone says that. Nobody cares. You think I care how your summer is? Think again, you old... What's that, Ted? Oh, great summer. And yours?" "Welcome to my world," she writes, "both of them. There is my spoken world, polite, cheerful, tolerant, and my inner world, silent, snooty, snide." End quote. The truth is, it is difficult to succeed in ministry if in your spoken world you are silent, snooty, and snide. Inauthentic as it may well be at times, polite, cheerful, and tolerant are what the role calls for, and fairly. The people we serve are so nice, so many of them, that early on in one's settlement or placement, some good soul is apt to say, encouragingly, "Don't worry, just be yourself." And in one way, that is a great goal, to do the ministry that is yours, in your own way. But being told just to be myself, part of me thinks, "Oh no, you deserve so much better than that." You deserve the minister I can be if I work at it and things happen to go well. Myself, you are paying good money for someone better than that to show up. Those of you who have taken part in a preaching course or a workshop with Jane and me, or read our book, may remember the poem by Wendell Berry. "Do not think me gentle because I speak in praise of gentleness, or elegant because I know the grace that keeps this world. I am a man, crude as any, gross of speech, intolerant, stubborn, angry, full of fits and furies. That I may have spoken well at times is not natural. A wonder is what it is." But if being a minister involves playing a role, let me add quickly, lest you take these remarks to be a justification or even a celebration of inauthenticity, it should be a role that suits us, that we do not take on fraudulently. I think that this is implicit in our professional relationships with those whom we serve. What they want is that minister each of us is uniquely suited to being, something between our real self, whatever that may be, and a phony self, at odds with who we really are. They want someone who can play that role in their lives and in their institutions. Having someone in that role enables persons and religious communities and agencies to accomplish the amazing, or at least the important, or at the very least the necessary, depending on the season. It is not a role that suits everyone. For some, their personalities do not fit snugly enough into the role and they are discomforted by it. Or there is an incongruity between their personalities and the role that discomforts others, that comes off as forced or inauthentic. There is an observation I credited for years to Paul Tournier, a Swiss Christian psychiatrist and author whose work was slightly popular when I was in theological school well back into the last century. Since taking on this assignment, I spent some time looking to see just where he made the point, without success. So the following point is maybe Dr. Tournier's, or maybe my response to the issues he stirred up, writing as much as he did about the self or person, one's actual being, and one's persona, who one is taken to be by others. The language, person and persona, was popularized by Carl Jung. For many of his followers, the persona is something to try to overcome to be more truly the person you are. But others have shown appreciation for the indispensability and value of the persona as the way a person has of being in the world. As Yolanda Jacoby wrote, "Each of us is obliged to play various roles in life and consequently to wear a mask. To the extent that everyone is part of an organized world and member of a social group, one has to have a persona. The development of a persona is, in fact, a universal human archetypal process which forms the growth of the soul and is essential to the attainment of maturity." This can be taken to extremes. Some will recall the disturbing suggestion made in Kurt Vonnegut's novel Mother Night that we are what we appear to be, so we must be careful about what we pretend to be. Or the ads for Canon cameras that proclaim appearance is everything. One does not want to leave behind all thought of authenticity, self-expression, being oneself, and the rest. From my encounter with Tournier's work, I took this two-part line of reasoning. One, our public appearance or persona and our personal personhood can never be exactly the same. I mean, people are projecting stuff on us all the time because of what we look like, what our job is, even what our names are. Maybe both Kens you dated in high school were obnoxious. We all know what can happen when the person sitting next to us on the plane finds out our line of work, how the projections can fall into place and in many different ways. Two, the goal is that person and persona should fit together well. They are two different things and always will be unless something has gone wrong and a person has lost herself or himself and has become that persona. I think we may all feel at times that this has become true, that we are no longer in touch with ourselves, so demanding has it been just then to be a minister, that we stay in that role, but this is not a desirable state to be in for long. The opposite threat is that our persona and person will become disassociated, so our ministries are just play-acting, unrelated to our true selves. This essay suggests that a degree of that disassociation is natural and to be expected, but I say again, my intent is not to champion inauthenticity or fraudulence. Having been on continental Unitarian Universalist groups like the Ministerial Fellowship Committee, I know that people can dissemble, can at least for a time present themselves as ministers when the role is merely a charade, or the gap can take a more subtle, sadder form. I once heard a colleague reflect back on his long career in ministry and his own rich and unusual spiritual life in a way that led me to ask how much his congregation had been aware of that spiritual side of his life. He said none of them would have had any idea of the spiritual ideas that had captivated him throughout his adulthood. Imagine. But maybe his congregation, his sense of it, was that his particular outlook was one that would not have fit the role they had called him to fill. There are times when the minister's dilemma is just that, to decide how much we are to be transparently, specifically ourselves, as honest and authentic as we can, and how much we are called upon to be the person they want us to be, or the person they seem to need us to be. At times, the role may be constraining and even objectionable in expectations, and we may well choose not to surrender one bit of ourselves. At other times, who we are really, truly, or what we are thinking or feeling needs to be conceded in part for the sake of the transforming, healing, consoling, guiding, even inspiring power of that ministerial role. I need to acknowledge that this role that I think has such promise and reward is not equally available to everyone. The strides we UUs have made since I entered ministry in 1970 are wondrous and wonderful as one prejudice after another has been dramatically reduced. But there is still work to be done. I am well aware that there is something a bit iffy about the role of ministry being celebrated by someone who looks the part to many people, especially to many outsiders to our movement, and does not have to overcome most biases. At the church I served just this past year, we had a woman from outside the congregation book the building for a wedding, agreeing that one of our ministers would perform the service, which was fine with her, until she heard that it would be the associate minister or one of the affiliate ministers, all of whom are women. No, she said to our administrator, I have always dreamed of just the wedding I want in a beautiful old New England church, which we have, conducted by a minister who is a man. She may even have visited one of our services when I was preaching and been excited that Central Casting had provided not just a man, but one of grandfatherly years with a gray beard. For her wedding, she went elsewhere. But But even white, straight men like me know at least some small part of the struggle to gain legitimacy in the role. At 26, I was minister to people my grandparents' age. And as an atheistic existentialist, my theology is not one all you use and few other religious people respect a whole lot. And being a straight white male is definitely not an asset in gaining legitimacy with some who have their own negative stereotypes of who that probably makes me. I long for the day when any qualified person is given an equal chance to try to earn and then receive the gift of the role of minister, and when the word qualified excludes no one for any of the wrong reasons. I say again, it is a gift, even if it comes with strings attached. It comes with expectations we may not welcome. In describing her decision to leave parish work, the Episcopal priest and author Barbara Brown Taylor writes, "In my role, I could act out my best nature for days at a time. I could produce kindness when all I felt was fatigue. I could produce patience when circumstances warranted irritation. I could shine like the sun until long after dark when I needed to. But my soul did not operate on a solar calendar. My soul operated on a lunar calendar, coming up at a different time every night and never looking the same way two nights in a row. Where my role called for a steady stream of bright light, my soul waxed and waned. The problem with the collar was that it did not allow for such variations." End quote. In various situations, there are other disadvantages as well. But so often, the role is such a gift. Brown herself acknowledges this in passages like this one. "As much as I hated hospital waiting rooms, I never doubted that I could do some good in them simply by showing up and staying put. It was one of those times when transference worked in my favor, by letting me go into parts of people's hearts where only God has any right to go." That is not my theology, but I know the feeling. I know how favored I have felt to have a role that let me go into parts of people's hearts where love and care could make a difference, and where they wanted me to be because they had given me the gift of that role. They give the gift because of the trust we have earned and go on earning. This is what happens with the ministerial interns by the time they have been around long enough for people to see that they can handle the role. They get given that gift. And those of us in our many forms of ministry get given the same gift when things go well, a role that lets us love and serve them. The congregation, young and old, the counselees, the hospital patients, the military personnel, and all the rest, including the movement itself. And isn't that what we are in ministry for? The chance to love and serve both the people we serve and the values that brought them and us to Unitarian Universalism. And all of them, the people we serve, they collude with us to let us be the people we want to be, because they want and often need to have that person in their lives, the minister, the one qualified and willing to accept the role and work with them at creating effective ministry. Now, there are times for any of us in the ministry when having to be the person in the minister's role is discomforting and difficult at best, and other times when we're just not in the mood, as Barbara Taylor Brown points out, times when it is sort of faking it. I am not free to decide in the middle of a counseling session that I would rather be fishing and just leave. No, I am going to look like I am paying attention. Even though, while I am trying hard and maybe mostly succeeding, I am not always succeeding completely. Even when listening to preaching in Kazi. It happens in my own preaching too. You know that wonderful state of having your words and your thoughts and your diction and your body all in sync, and every sentence comes out with just the ideas and the inflection and the emotion you had when you were preparing that sermon? But there are times when my brain is thinking, I'm not sure I understand what I just said. Or what I'm saying now. Still, maybe if I keep going and read it well, obviously I work from a manuscript, maybe they will hear better than I am just now. And so often they do. There is a poem by Billy Collins that contains these lines. I am listening to a blues singer named Precious Bryant singing a song called Fool Me Good. If you don't love me, baby, she sings, would you please try to fool me good? Yes, Precious, I reply. I will fool you as good as I can. But first I have to listen to you with my whole heart. Actually, as to the love itself, the love we have for them and for the religion we share, I do not think that that can be faked for long. But the way that love is lived out in our ministry is not always an expression of our truest nature or our mood at the moment. No, it is our effort in our own ways of filling the role of minister as best we can. We owe that to them. We may not owe them our true, authentic selves at every moment of every day, or we are doomed, but we owe them that, to stay in the role as best we can. They did not ordain or call or employ us to be ourselves, but to be the ministers we are capable of being, all of us in our own ways, and to listen with our whole hearts. Because then we can and do become, at least every now and then, mediators of mercy, agents of love, instruments of redemption, revealers of grace, proponents of peace, instigators of justice, and midwives to communities and relationships of affection and faith. As the sailor said, hey, do you know who you are? Of course you do. And they do too. You are their minister, someone willing to take on that role, to be that person in the lives of those who give us that gift, those people who can see us and say and know and be grateful that it's the minister.
Ken, this is really a terrible topic for the end of the church year. Some of us are coiled to be blessedly sprung from work for a long summer's rest, so close we can almost taste it. I hear it was Jeff Merritt, husband of our good colleague Barbara, who coined the term the May speech. A behind-closed-doors diatribe, which includes some variation of, I can't sit through another minute of one more meeting. I have not a remaining ounce of compassion, real or imagined. And my personal favorite, I hate every hymn in the hymnal. You confirm my sense that when we leave, we should consider giving the role a vacation to. Many years ago, unsuspecting and amazed, Cam and I arrived in San Francisco just in time for that very gay city's Gay Pride celebration. Completely caught up in the way over the topness of it all, I announced that I wanted to march wearing not much more than shredded dungaree shorts and a black lace bra. Kem absolutely forbade it. You just can't go into public like that, she said. And she didn't mean that one can't. She was talking about me. I pouted. I was on vacation and I don't get out much. The response was a firm and final no. Kem's great-grandfather was the governor of Nebraska. Her stepmother was a state senator. She gets it about role. So I dressed.
And we rode BART into the city.
Coming up from underground, just as we stepped onto the street, someone called out, Reverend Kem, Reverend Kem. I froze, a deer in the headlights. And Kem, bless her heart, was only sympathetic and took no pleasure in being right. You said, Ken, that we know what complex and interesting people we are, and that maybe the woman who opens the door and says, it's the minister, knows it too. I say that this assumption would be our biggest mistake. Not only does she not know who we are, she really doesn't want to. Nor, as you say, should she know. By definition, minister really gives a whole new meaning to the word vanilla. Obviously, it's not that there's no pleasure in the role. In 1768, Reverend Mr. Amos Adams of First Church in Roxbury, Massachusetts, preached an ordination sermon entitled, The Pleasures Peculiar to the Ministerial Life. The next time you're in Boston, I commend you to an hour in the rare books section of the library, just to be reminded of those pleasures peculiar. It feels a little like you've just caught us marching in our underwear, Ken. I'm resisting the urge to channel my mother. What will people think? So let's lift up those pleasures again, just to remind ourselves, mediators of mercy, agents of love, instruments of redemption, and revealers of grace. Thank you for that. It would make a nice t-shirt. Kind of like a consolation prize for not getting to wear the one that says, you must have mistaken me for someone who cares. Oh, the longing to give in to the siren's song, to be seduced yet again by the magic and mystery of the role and ignore its terrible underbelly. He resisted it mightily, Ken, making for a courageous passage, hard on the spirit. Do you know who you are? It's a worthy koan. I wonder if we wear a mask long enough, does our face underneath begin to resemble it? Or do we live on the fault line of the abuse of power? Or drown in the profound loneliness of substance abuse and addictions and failed intimacies, so that when the mask is removed, there's no one there at all. You suggest some kind of both and, Ken, mask on, mask off, as a way of appreciating the gift with strings attached. Maybe to love this gift and to keep loving it, we need to open the valve on the pressure cooker to let out the steam once in a while. The first time I ever saw a pressure cooker was when I was in the sixth grade. Actually, what I saw just after I heard my friend's mother yelling in the kitchen was the pot with its cover blown off and beets everywhere, including on the ceiling. Everything looked as though it were bleeding. That image returned to me at a point early in my ministry when, I'm sorry to report, I was feeling like the pot, spent and empty. What I understand from you now, Ken, is that the precariousness of the cover on the preciousness of my feelings was not due to the fact that, though the once empty church was now full, the finance committee thought it unbecoming to entertain a proposal to give the minister a raise. Nor was it due to the fact that, though we had no idea how the virus was being transmitted, I had just buried my fifth parishioner to die with AIDS in a 3-week period. My cover was straining against the steam, rising from the restraint called for by my role. Speaking of unbecoming, saying what I really felt to the finance committee regarding their parsimony, or shaking a fist at to whom it may concern regarding my dead parishioners, would have been a little like parading the holy shorts and bra in public. It's just not done. Here is an opportunity for me to thank our esteemed colleague, Judith Walker Riggs, who told me at the perfect moment, you have to know where to put your okay and where to put your not okay. But what you call the minister's dilemma, Ken, cannot really be engaged at the gym or anywhere we are blessedly anonymous. It can only be deeply addressed somewhere we are known and accountable, somewhere we can ask ourselves, do you know who you are? And wait for the roiled pool unto which we have been lowered to settle, so the answers will be clear and we can heal. My own answers may be different from each of yours, but I would urge us in some regular, quiet hour to make a place where the valve can be tapped wide open, both alone and with people with whom we can rant and rave, cry our hearts out, and laugh ourselves sick. Thank you, Ken. Above all, thanks for reminding us of the love.